Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. Subscribe to our free email newsletter to get the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day, or check out our excellent and newly updated smartphone app, or our website at SupChina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you this week from George Washington University in our nation's capital, which I fondly call Beijing. Thanks to the generous invitation of students who run the GW chapter of Global China Connect, I am delighted to see so many people here. So let's hear you make some noise. So with me, of course, is Jeremy Goldcorn, who's editor-in-chief of SupChina, who come all the way from Nashville, Tennessee, from Goldcorn Holler on a mule cart just so you can do this show. Greet the people, Art Jeremy.
Hi, y'all. I do actually live in a holler now. So,
you do.
Yeah,
technically,
I,
it is a holler.
I'm a hillbilly.
All right. Well, and I will write your elegy. Anyway, I think very few would contest the assertion that the bilateral relationship between China and the United States is the most important diplomatic relationship we face today, and it is one that has had its share of vicissitudes, its share of ups and downs, and still faces very significant challenges today. Last week, Chinese President Xi Jinping joined President Donald Trump at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida for a very, very important summit that was, of course, overshadowed by the American attack on a Syrian airbase in response to Bashar al-Assad's apparent nerve agent attack that killed 89 people, including many children. So we now have an opportunity to hear about Mar-a-Lago from someone who is actually there and who has been working on the U.S.-China relationship across now three U.S. presidencies as a career foreign service officer.
And right now, a U.S. carrier group is in fact steaming towards the Korean Peninsula, and there's no doubt a flurry of diplomatic activity between Washington and Beijing related to the Korean situation. So we are doubly delighted to be joined by Susan Thornton, Acting Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, who has taken the time out of what must be a really busy schedule to speak with us. Assistant Secretary Thornton, Susan, if I may, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you so much, Jeremy, and thank you, Kaiser. It's very great to be here. I'm happy to be here with all my friends at GW, and I'm especially happy to be here with Jeremy and Kaiser. You know, I spent 25 years as a diplomat, but I've always wanted to be in a rock and roll band, Kaiser. So maybe after I retire, you'll find a spot for me.
Hey, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, I've been looking for a singer, and I think you fit the bill perfectly. So anyway, since we're in D.C., and indeed we are in Foggy Bottom, which is just sense though from the State Department, and since we're in an audience that includes many students, I want to talk to you first about your own career, before your rock music career, but
great.
Your own career in the Foreign Service. You started as a diplomat in Chengdu and in Beijing, right? Overlapped with you for quite a while. Right?
Yes.
That was 2000 to 2007, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And then you were deputy assistant at your current bureau for the last 3 years before your recent appointment. So how did you get started in the Foreign Service? As I understand it, I mean, you actually have something in common with me. We both started focusing on Russia, right?
That is true. I started off as a Russian speaker, and actually long before I came into the Foreign Service, I spent time in Russia. I'm actually very interested in the post-communist transitions, economic transitions, which is how I got started with Russian. And then, of course, you know, most interesting of post-communist transitions or not post-communist transitions is China. So I switched to that at one point and have been looking at the two ever since.
And Susan, you started in Chengdu in 2000, so that was a few months after the embassy bombing in Belgrade, and the situation, if I remember rightly, had already calmed down some. But you were in China for the EP3 incident, But after that, it seems things were pretty calm in the bilateral relationship for the rest of your tenure in China. Is that your perception?
Things are never totally calm in the U.S.-China relationship. But yeah, I think after the George W. Bush transition from Bill Clinton and the initial crisis over the EP3 in the Bush administration, things seem to sort of revert to a kind of a workmanlike relationship in the bilateral relationship. And we were able to, I think, manage differences very effectively as, of course, the economic relationship was booming at that time. And so I think the, you know, business relationship really helped provide the ballast in the relationship and get us through some of the other troubling patches that we encountered.
So what were the major issues that you encountered at that time?
Oh, we had a lot of focus on trying to make progress on IPR theft was one of the big topics that Ambassador Sandy Rant at that time in Beijing was very focused on. Human rights was a huge issue at that time. We had a number of very high-profile cases, and we had an ongoing human rights dialogue. When I was in Chengdu, I covered Tibet and traveled frequently to Tibet. At that time, the Tibet Autonomous Region and other parts, autonomous regions, Tibetan regions in China were quite open. Mm-hmm. And that was before the
March 2008
incidents and then the lead up to the Olympic Games in Beijing. So we're starting.
You'd actually gone off to Kazakhstan,
I was in Kazakhstan in the 90s, right after Kazakhstan became a new country, and we opened the embassy there.
But then after 2007,
I went back to Central Asia to Turkmenistan.
To hang out with Turkmenbashi.
Right.
To discuss human rights.
Exactly.
Now that's a whole other podcast. We'd love to hear your stories about Turkmenistan.
We'll do it.
I mean that is just one crazy place. I mean I'd be really really fascinated to hear about that. But you actually missed a lot of the fireworks that happened after that epical year 2012 with the Chen Guangcheng and his little sojourn in the American Embassy, and of course the Wang Lijun thing. Which was in your old stomping ground.
My old stomping grounds, absolutely.
Well, I
my good friend Pete Heyman, who I worked with on China when I came back to China, was in Chengdu for the Wang Lijun incident, but he's in Thailand now. So
one of the big issues that was on your watch, I guess, in 2007 was the U.S. was working very very hard to push China on Darfur. Actually ran into Tom Christensen over the weekend, and he was complaining about how all the credit somehow got given to Mia Farrow and Steven Spielberg.
We did work very hard. I mean, that was really the beginning of trying to get China to step up to the plate and contribute more to the U.N. system, to resolving international and global challenges, especially the so-called hotspot issues. And South Sudan was definitely one of those hotspot issues. Darfur was another one. And trying to get the Chinese to step up and contribute more on things like that was a big part of what we were doing in the 2000s in China. This was after, of course, Robert Zoellick pronounced the famous responsible stakeholder. And so we worked very hard to try to get them to be more engaged and sort of stepping outside of their comfort zone and resolving international crises.
When we talked to Susan Shirk not too long ago, she talked about how she felt this kind of thrill when Xi Jinping gave his speech at Davos. She felt like all that work she had put in had kind of paid off. And here they were kind of singing from the same hymn book, that they had been enrolled in the international system that way. I wonder if you had a similar feeling when you heard that.
Well, I think for me, what I noticed about Xi Jinping's speech at Davos was sort of China stepping up and really saying that they're going to uphold the international system, that they're not looking to upend it. And that is something that we had been really pushing, and we're always pushing China, shape China's policies so that they contribute to upholding the international rules-based system and that they further that system, not trying to set up a competing system.
And do you feel, if I may step ahead of it, I mean, if you look at now, 2017, do you think that they are, in fact, doing that to, you know, a greater or lesser extent?
It depends. I think in a lot of areas, China has really come out on the global stage. They've expanded their assistance programs in Africa and even in Latin America, which is a new area for them. They're working to help resolve crises in the Middle East, but not in a very high-profile way. They still prefer to keep a low-profile engagement. They like to contribute to crises and solutions to problems bilaterally rather than through the multilateral, like UN system or international agency system. So I think we still have a long way to go, but they're definitely stepping up and contributing more across the board.
So I always like to point out that during the period, say, between September 11th and the Lhasa riots that we talked about, that period where you were in China, Jeremy had noted that it was a relatively calm period. It was also a period where I felt, at least, like many of the areas where we want to see China make advances in rule of law, in civil liberties, in the public sphere, in relative media freedoms. I felt like a lot of those areas were making advances during the George W. Bush administration, on your watch. Coincidence, mm-hmm. Perhaps.
Coincidence, perhaps not.
I'm wondering what you think was the reason. Was it because China had been enrolled in the global war on terror and didn't feel a threat? Was it just sort of something characteristic of the Hu and Wen era, or what was it? Why the sudden illiberal turn in 2009, and what were we doing differently before?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I think that we were necessarily doing something different before, but there was a period of kind of intellectual ferment in China during mm-hmm. those years. I think the academic and intellectual scene in China started to open up. You obviously had a lot of people that had studied abroad or were going to study abroad and bringing back new ideas. The economy was really taking off. You had a lot of influx of foreign investment into China. And so I think maybe all of these factors combined to sort of produce that kind of intellectual ferment. People were looking for dynamism in the economy. And I think in the Hu and Wen era, it's possible that, you know, there just wasn't as much attention being paid to top-down party orthodoxy. It was more an era of kind of experimentation, maybe.
And do you think American diplomacy must have had some role to play there in fostering at least an international environment where they felt they were safe to experiment that way?
Yeah, I think we had a very good U.S.-China relationship. It felt very stable, so I think that probably helped create an enabling environment that let China kind of let more ideas come to the fore, felt a little bit maybe safer in experimenting. After the Tiananmen Square riots and incident, it took quite a number of years to reestablish the U.S.-China relationship. So we really didn't get back into our regular swing of things until basically the mid-90s or so. So probably between getting things back into sort of regular flow of dialogues and other conversations up through the early 2000s, I think at that point maybe they felt like the relationship was solid enough. We were having pretty rich discussions, for example, on human rights. We were working on things like village elections with the Carter Center and other groups. So I think that was a period that sort of they were getting kind of increasing confidence maybe in the relationship.
Susan, can I interrupt? And just because this is one of Kaiser's pet things is looking at this period of time. And one of his theories that he didn't quite ask you exactly what he means, I believe, is his feeling that during that period of time, the U.S. backed off, at least publicly, in terms of criticizing China about human rights and many other things that the U.S. likes to criticize China about. And that, to an extent, gave them the breathing room domestically to or a lack of pressure that allowed a certain kind of liberalism that ended in 2009.
Wouldn't call it liberalism, but
so the theory is that if you give them the space and don't criticize, that then they become more liberal.
Yeah,
and
it wasn't criticism so
theory?
Much. Well, it was sort of this is pre-color revolutions, pre-Arab Spring, and they didn't feel that they were in the crosshairs. They didn't feel like there was this project of regime change ultimately.
Well, I mean, I think that there was a lot of criticism of China going on at that point. I mean, I felt
Absolutely,
like we were constantly engaged in, actually, even though the relationship was it felt fairly stable, it had the usual categorization of problems. But I think we were not reticent about calling China out on things, but maybe, I mean, we hadn't had, you know, the color revolutions were coming along there in the mid sort of 2000s.
Mm-hmm. They're distant still, though.
Georgia, right? Yeah, Central Asia, but the Arab Spring was, of course, right. Much later. Right. But I think, you know, if you got to look at the economy, Communist Party of China's legitimacy comes basically from its economic growth, yeah. Its performance on the economy. And since the economy was booming, double-digit growth was being delivered every year. They were also probably, you know, very confident on that front.
That certainly was a factor. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Susan, I suggested at the top of the podcast that you've been busy, but really your bureau must have been busy nonstop, not just since the inauguration, but since the election. We've seen Defense Secretary James Mattis go to Asia, Japanese President Abe come to the United States, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, of course, went to Japan, Korea, and China, and then there was Xi Jinping's visit last week. So we've read a lot in the media about staffing issues at the State Department. If I may ask, how has your bureau fared during the transition and early into the administration? And if I can just extend the question, are there maybe some benefits to a more stripped-down bureaucracy that most people at the State Department that I've talked to don't necessarily agree with?
Well, look, our bureau has gotten a lot of attention from this administration the first few months, and we have several hundred people in our bureau. They've been fully employed, and they feel like they've gotten a lot of attention, that our region's gotten the amount of attention that it deserves. I mean, it's a very dynamic and important place, and so I think we have had no problems in working with the new incoming team since Secretary Tillerson was confirmed. We've been in, you know, constant contact with him and his staff and briefing and providing papers. And I went on the trip with him to Northeast Asia. I went down to Mar-a-Lago, as you mentioned. So I think we don't see that there's been really any problem in kind of keeping up with the flow of work. You know, there's some people at the State Department that may think we need more people. You know, I personally think that it is worth having a look now. We've had a few years of growth under sort of the Iraq and Afghanistan and OCO budgets, et cetera. And it's worth having a look at our structure and our staffing. We have really major influx of officers in response to visa workload following on all of the 9/11 and post 9/11. And every year it seems we have new requirements in visa issuance. So that's been a real area of growth for us. And, you know, it's good to sort of stop and take a look and see how your balance is and what all of the staffing patterns look like and make sure it's the most efficient that it can be. So I don't have a problem with that. And I think most people at the State Department actually welcome the chance to kind of scrutinize our staffing. We would rather not do it probably under threat of, you know, huge budget cuts, because usually when you reorganize under the threat of a huge budget cut, you don't make the most efficient reorganizations. But anyway, we're looking at all of these things, and I think we're pretty sanguine about what the future holds.
So you've actually straddled now not just one transition, but two. And so you have experience with these three administrations now. I'm curious what you see in terms of changes in the culture of diplomacy in the way that state operates, and with your counterparts in China as well. Maybe walk us through what some of these changes have been like for you as a career foreign service officer.
Well, the most obvious thing is when I came in 92, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have the 24-hour cable news cycle.
Right.
So the information explosion has really changed, both brought more opportunities for diplomacy, but also created sort of a lot of competing spaces for the work that we do. And getting our message out, I think, clearly to our audiences, both here in the U.S. and overseas, gets more complicated as the media environment becomes balkanized. So I think that is the biggest area of difference. Of course, technology's brought all kinds of benefits and added opportunities too, but it does make it harder. You know, you used to be able to speak to an audience and pretty much think that you were only communicating with that audience. So you can, in diplomacy, you want to be able to tailor your message for different audiences. You can't really do that anymore. So everyone's going to hear everything that you say, and they're going to detect the, you know, the slight differences between statements.
So even if we edit this podcast, somebody in the audience might be tweeting
they're
it.
They're tweeting exactly. Right. That guy right there.
That guy right there.
So if you, for example, were to say, the pivot is dead, you know.
I would never say that, but yeah.
Could I rephrase a bit of Kaiser's question in terms of Chinese diplomacy, you know, and aside from the information overload aspect of it, how have Chinese diplomats changed the way they work over the period of time you've been working with them?
Well, I have to say that Chinese diplomats and actually also Russian diplomats that I've dealt with, they're very good, very professional, very highly skilled and highly trained. And we always look forward to our sessions in discussion, negotiation, or making our points to our diplomatic counterparts because they're pretty tough. But I think that the Chinese diplomats, you know, the big difference is in sort of level of professionalization. I mean, they're language skills, their levels of training, their sophistication, they're very cosmopolitan. And I think one of the big differences, though, is that their system is a lot more top-down, whereas our system is a little bit more, dare I say it, democratic. We try to get our junior officers out, you know, on to do speaking, to do outreach. We promote that kind of thing, whereas, you know, they tend to be much more stick to the talking points, read your messages.
Not a lot of public diplomacy.
Not a lot of variation among the various conversations that you're going to have, that kind of thing.
So basically, the political cultures of the two countries are completely reflected in their whole diplomatic course. Yeah, not a surprise at all. Let's pin you on this whole pivot is dead thing, though.
I did not say that. Right, that was the headline writer.
Right. The headline writer wrote that. But, you know, some people just...
Can you set it up, Kaiser?
Yeah, okay. So, you know, there were people who were saying, yeah, that Susan Thornton said the pivot is dead. This is your opportunity now to set the record straight and to get it with context and all. You can unpack that as much as you want. What did you really say, and what did you actually mean with respect to the so-called rebalancing or pivot?
Yeah. So, you know, the whole idea of the pivot, the rebalance, was introduced by the last administration after the focus on Afghanistan and Iraq to make it clear that the U.S. considered Asia a vital region for our future, for our future prosperity, for our security interests, and that we were not neglecting Asia. I think in the period since the pivot slash rebalance was declared, I think we've made it pretty clear that the U.S. is not going anywhere. Asia is crucially important. And I think in this administration, because they've already all focused so much on Asia and paid so much attention to it, it hasn't been necessary to say that we're focusing a lot of attention on Asia, because they've shown it through their actions and through their visits and through the summits and all of that. So I think the bottom line is the U.S. is a Pacific power. We're going to be in Asia. It's the most economically dynamic region in the world, and we've got to be there for, you know, everything that this administration is trying to do in developing U.S. prosperity. Even though they say America first, part of America first is U.S. engagement in Asia.
So one of the problems with the pivot maybe was just its name. I often think that because, I mean, when I first heard it, I started thinking of a machine gun mounted on, you know,
that's just you.
That turns.
But sure. I mean, many Chinese people certainly saw it as some species of containment, right?
Right. And I think that's where the renaming of rebalance came in, the rebalance to Asia, because the pivot... It also wasn't something that, you know, our European allies and partners thought was necessarily the right way of putting it. You know, of course, we want to be engaged in Asia, but we're also going to, of course, be engaged in Europe as well.
Kurt Campbell didn't get the memo, though, when he wrote his book.
He loved the word pivot, right, I think. Right. So,
a little basketball fan.
Yeah. It's very action-oriented. Right. So,
It's a basketball term. You see, I'm still illiterate in American sports. I didn't realize that. Susan, if you look back over the last 17 or so years that you've been engaged with China, what do you see as the major inflection points? What are the major happenings in the bilateral relationship?
Oh, so many.
Pick
well,
three.
Yeah. Two, yeah. Two, three, right? Two or three. Well, I think... I think 9/11 was a big inflection point for U.S. relations with every country in the world.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
I was in China for 9/11. I was out in Chengdu. So that was a very major one, I think, that kind of changed in a way the way the Chinese and the U.S.-China relationship was looked at by both us and the Chinese. It sort of pushed us to focus more on cooperation. And so maybe part of the reason why U.S.-China relations seemed steady in that period was because of that push. You know, we were very focused on the Great War on Terror, and I think the Chinese were, you know, seeing it in their interest to do what they could to contribute to that.
ETIM was on the list now. And
yeah,
we're
exactly,
happy,
exactly. And then, I don't know, I would say the Beijing Olympics was another big inflection point. China coming out on the world stage, getting their swagger on. That really kind of...
And followed so quickly by the financial crisis, too.
Yes, exactly right. The Olympics and then the financial crisis would be, you know, sort of part of the same inflection point,
right.
And then I would say, you know, probably sort of the Sunnyland Summit and Hu Jintao sort of ascension to the
Xi Jinping.
Oh, sorry. What did I say? Xi Jinping. Sorry.
Right. No, of course.
We'll edit that out.
We know exactly what you meant. Because Hu Jintao certainly wasn't.
No.
Well, I guess what I'm really most curious about is the illiberal turn that happened, really. I would put it at that second inflection point that you mean, you know, the 2009-ish. This is something that fascinates me. I have a kind of catch-all name for I call it the new truculence, this whole basket of illiberal kind of policies, both domestic and foreign, that came out during that. I'm wondering if you see it that way, and if you see some explanation as to why that has happened.
Well, I think it's probably a combination of factors. I mean, I think certainly the focus around the absolute necessity of having a successful Olympics was preceded by there's a necessity to crack down on any kind of unrest that was becoming visible and might have a chance of marring or spoiling this big coming out event. So, and that kind of created its own problem. I kind of trace the sort of illiberal turn or the willingness, seeming greater willingness to crack down kind of reflexively to the events in Lhasa in March that you mentioned.
Reinforced next year in Urumqi.
Yeah,
right?
It just continued and carried on, and with the events in Xinjiang and then we had sort of the focus on legitimacy of the Communist Party in the post-Arab Spring. And I think the Arab Spring is, as you mentioned, and also a very powerful kind of causal focal point for some of this activity, too.
Yeah. Should we get to the present now?
Yeah. So, you know, we have to talk a little bit about the visit to Mar-a-Lago. But before we ask what happened there, and you might not be able to tell us everything that we want to know, ahead of the visit, a number of pundits were arguing that the administration wasn't really ready, that it wasn't the time for a summit of heads of state because the U.S. just didn't have a clear agenda or enough understanding of China's agenda. What would your take on that be?
Well, they didn't know they had Susan Thorne at the helm.
Well, first of all, I just have to let everyone know it's very hard to pronounce Mar-a-Lago if you're Chinese, apparently, because they had a very hard time with the name. So all of the people kept the protocol people and the security people kept trying to pronounce the name, and it was pretty tough for them. I'm not sure why, but Mar-a-Lago. Yeah, it was very hard. It was very hard. So, but no, I think. Okay, well, there's a question that you face with
worse
any
if you're
new
Japanese,
administration.
Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, that's true. Worse if you're Japanese. But I think the question that you face is, you know, it is, as you said, the most consequential relationship we have, the most important. And, you know, it's not always smooth sailing with China. So if you do not have a way of convening these two leaders early on, and you wait until you've got sort of the table all set to have a long list of deliverables or outcomes for the summit, it may be quite a long time before you can establish some kind of relationship between these two leaders. So I think it was, in the end, recognized that, okay, we're not going to have a long list of, you know, results from this meeting, but we still need to have the two leaders meet and at least try to get to know one another, establish a rapport, and, you know, make sure that they can, you know, at least know each other so that they can, you know, make a phone call or use the hotline if there's a crisis. And I think that, you know, it is an argument that you can have that we're not going to be ready. But usually negotiations over substantive deliverables take quite some time. And so if you wait for all that time, then you're necessarily going to be waiting quite a long time.
So speaking of deliverables, Agence France-Presse said that Xi Jinping and his team went in with a list of tweetable deliverables, which was quite a cute phrase. President Trump joked that at one point, so far I've got absolutely nothing. But in the end, did he get something? Did he get deliverables, tweetable or not?
Was it 70,000 jobs? What were they said? 70,000 jobs and...
Lots of jobs.
Crack down on banking in North Korea, North Korean banking through Chinese banks, and a couple of other things, right?
Yeah, well, I remember before the summit when Jack Ma from Alibaba came over to meet with President Trump, and he said he was going to have Alibaba produce, I think it was 1 million jobs in the United States by opening up his platform for e-commerce in the United States. So this seems to be a kind of recurring theme. But I think, you know, the Chinese wanted to come and present this 100-day plan to resolve trade issues because, you know, I think given the rhetoric in the campaign and then in the post-campaign period from the president, they were quite worried about what the economic agenda was going to be and what was going to be expected. And they wanted to try to, I think, show that they were being responsive. In the end, what we agreed on is that we would have a plan to have a 100-day list of things that we were going to have as outcomes and that we would have to talk about what those would be. So the 100-day plan from the Chinese side wasn't quite up to what I think the U.S. side was looking for, but that we've agreed that a 100-day plan is a good idea.
Starting from day 83 or whatever it was.
Well, whatever day today. I think today is, you know, today is day one or tomorrow's day one. Okay. You know, around 100 days.
So I'm curious about the whole breaking of the news of the strike on Syria, which happened, of course, like over chocolate cake. I think it was he explained that he told the most delicious chocolate cake ever. I think it was described that way to Fox. Had your team been briefed ahead of time about that this was going to be happening? Did you have some inkling? And yeah. I'm also curious how the Chinese reacted to this whole thing.
Yeah, well, the chemical weapons strike in Syria was fairly fresh news, but it wasn't that day's news. But there had been a decision-making process building within the U.S. government about what to do in response to that strike. And it just so happened that the decision-making process kind of culminated on the day that Xi Jinping was coming to Mar-a-Lago. Mm. And so I think the decision was made that day, but the question about how to inform the Chinese, you know, and what would be the issues there, what would be their reaction, I think it was considered. I think the overriding factor was to send the proper signal in response to the horrible chemical weapons attack, and that the Chinese would, since chemical weapons are certainly outlawed internationally, and the Chinese have been very consistent in supporting that position, that they would understand this response.
Yeah, and in the interview that he gave with Fox's Maria Bartiromo, President Trump said that Xi Jinping had asked the translator to repeat, and then after a beat, he said that this was an appropriate response, that anyone who would use gas
chemical weapons on their own people
sort of had it coming, right?
Well, I don't know if he said exactly that, but he did, you know, President Trump did tell him at the dinner. Mm-hmm. He said he didn't want them to go back to their hotel room, turn on, you know, CCTV and see that this had happened while they were eating dinner. So he wanted to give him a heads up. And normally in diplomacy, you know, that's the polite thing to do. You don't want people to be surprised. You give them a heads up. I don't know whether the Chinese were, because at that point, once the Syria strike had happened, then a lot of the international media attention went to that issue and not to covering the actual U.S.-China meeting that was happening. But on the other hand, there was press venues at the summit used to cover the U.S.-China meeting. And then a lot of the questions were about Syria. And so I think they got coverage, maybe not as much as they wanted, but certainly Chinese media covered the whole thing in its entirety. So I think they were probably surprised. The Chinese don't like surprises, so maybe that part wasn't so great. But I think in all, it was handled, you know, pretty smoothly.
The pundits, of course, tried to connect these two things and to suggest, I can predict your response, but, you know, that this was intended to send a message to show that kind of resolution, to maybe even intimidate, that this was ultimately to telegraph something about North Korea.
Well, I mean, like I said, from what I saw, it was all about making sure that we had a timely response to the actual events in the Middle East. I think, you know, we didn't want this event to upset the Chinese meeting at all. So, but it just happened coincidentally that the timing was such that it had to go off at that time. And I don't think it was meant to, I mean, there wasn't any connection in the American mind. There may be connections in the minds of, you know, people who are looking at these things a bit more conspiratorially, but I don't think that was intended.
Plenty of those about these days.
Yes.
So what about North Korea now? We're seeing reports today suggesting that Beijing is putting its foot down on North Korea, perhaps in response to the phone call between Trump and Xi. And Reuters reported on, they said it was a People's Daily editorial that was quite strongly worded against North Korea. But Kais and I were actually looking for the editorial. We couldn't find it on the People's Daily. So they probably took it from the Global Times or somewhere
Huan
else.
Yeah, Huan Xiaoxiba, I think it was Global Times.
Yeah, which is not, you know, an authoritative official paper, but nonetheless often reflects a view that has some currency in Beijing.
Right.
Beijing also seems to have put more teeth in the coal import ban it had announced earlier, although I always am very cynical about the reports about these things, because you don't really want to believe anything that anybody says about goods moving about China. But what is going on in North Korea? What is China doing? What's your take on the current situation?
Well, I mean, this problem of the nuclear program and missile program in North Korea has been a focus of concern for a long, long time. And we've been working with the Chinese to try to address this problem, you know, for many, many years. And I think what is new now is that the North Korean missile program has made strides that are leading it to be able to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile with potentially a nuclear warhead on it, which is a game changer from the perspective of the United States and from the perspective of the international community. It makes North Korea now an urgent global threat. And I think the Chinese, you know, have been increasingly frustrated with North Korea, but they see that this is really a game-changing move for the international community, and especially the United States and our allies in Northeast Asia. So we've been spending the last several years, but particularly the last, I would say, 2 years, working to increase the pressure through the international community's enforcement of sanctions against North Korea to try to increase the pressure on the regime and get them to make a decision about abandoning their weapons program. And I think, you know, until they started really showing this rapid fire testing program, there was a level of concern, but it was not at the level that it's at now. And with the rapid number of tests, they did more than, I think, 20 missile tests last year. They've done a number of nuclear tests. It's really progressing their program at a rate that we can't afford, can't sustain. And I think the Chinese are getting that, hearing the urgency on the part of us and on the part of others, and understanding that this can't continue. So they have signed up to really tough UN Security Council resolutions. They have committed to implement these sanctions to block imports of coal. As you say, they don't have a great record on implementing a lot of these things, so we're keeping a close eye on it. But they did turn back, you know, shipments of coal that had been sitting in Chinese ports this week. And they have said that they are willing to do more and will work with the international community to increase cooperation. So I think the president's message to Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago was pretty clear and pretty firm. And she, I think, has already become frustrated with North Korea and was already understanding that China has to do more to cooperate. And so I think you'll see them moving to try to increase their cooperation with the rest of the international community on this. Whether it'll be enough to satisfy us, I don't know, and we're going to keep watching.
So just to be clear, is that all within the framework of current UN sanctions, or is this something above and beyond that? And if so, what else, what other levers does China actually have to pull? I mean, remittances or...
Right. So, well, first of all, the Chinese have committed to implement the current sanctions, and they're not doing enough on that front yet. So they could be doing a lot more to block financial transactions with sanctioned companies, to, you know, block transactions that are prohibited with other sanctioned entities, et cetera. But in addition to that, we want them to consider doing more. And they have a lot of levers, since 90% of North Koreans' economy sort of flows somehow across the border from China or across the water from China. So I think, you know, there's the implementation of this kind of dragnet on, you know, illicit transactions in China is very difficult, since, you know, it's up to local governments to actually undertake this kind of research work and implementation, the police work, et cetera. And we're trying to basically encourage them to put a lot more resources into finding these transactions and blocking them and stopping them.
Susan, if I may ask just one more question about North Korea. I was there a few years, quite well, 10 years ago, and I did the little foreigner tour that they take you around on Pyongyang, and you go to the DMZ. And one of the, aside from monuments and, you know, dear leaders that are embalmed, one of the things they show you with a great deal of pride is this American surveillance boat, whose name slips my mind
right now.
The Pueblo, that's right. And this is a great victory in the war against the American imperialists, and, you know, it's a very proud part of the tour. And, you know, being on that boat, this kind of pathetic little relic, you know, from 1967, held up with such pride, made me think that, you know, if maybe you would just talk to North Korea, maybe something could be worked out. I mean, does anybody in the State Department ever discuss the idea of
recognition and direct talks?
If not recognition, immediate talk directly to them. Is that an idea that has any currency at all, or is that just not a subject that anyone will go near?
Oh my goodness. We have talked to North Korea, you know, directly on many occasions in the past, and we have, you know, gotten into negotiations. We have, you know, provided for light water nuclear reactors to North Korea. We have provided humanitarian assistance to North Korea. I led a group of people to Pyongyang in the late 90s to have a negotiation on provision of food assistance to North Korea. So there have been many, many, many occasions in the last three decades or so where we have tried very hard to engage in direct talks with North Korea, and every single time our goodwill and good intentions have been met with, you know, unfortunately, cheating and other forms of duplicitousness. And we just can't really have another round where we sort of enter into talks hoping the North Koreans will sort of do what they've committed to do. We've got to see them take actions that indicate that there is some serious chance of them abandoning these weapons programs, because at the end of the day, it's about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And if we can't see some tangible sign that they are willing to be serious about talking about that, then what are we really talking about?
Okay.
You know, she spent time in Turkmenistan. She knows from crazy dictators. We have to remember that. This is a woman who really knows what she's talking about. Let's take a question from the audience here. We have a little stack of cards here. This is, of course, something that we'd wanted to ask. At this point, how do you see cross-strait relations under Trump and Tsai and Xi progressing as compared to how it progressed under Obama and Ma and Xi?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. I mean, this... you know, this administration, of course, you know, in the transition period post-election but pre-inauguration, the president in December did take a telephone call from Tsai Ing-wen, the leader of Taiwan, and that was a fairly unprecedented communication that happened there. Of course, he said, you know...
Notice how she said leader, right? A very, very trained diplomat here we're talking about.
Of course, the president said that, you know, well, she just called me to congratulate me, et cetera. But that did create some ripples across the strait in mainland China and Beijing. And the Chinese made very clear their, you know, firm, longstanding position and made clear that they were very hopeful that the U.S. would stand by its commitments with regard to the cross-strait situation as we had set out in the three joint communiques that were signed back at the time when we reestablished diplomatic relations with People's Republic of China, or established for the first time with People's Republic of China. So there was a series of back and forth discussions on this. I think a lot of briefings were held, and soon after the inauguration, the president did have a phone call with Xi Jinping in which he sort of reiterated and reaffirmed the United States' One China policy. And, you know, I think over since that phone call and in a series of conversations since then, and then again at Mar-a-Lago, you know, the president has made clear that, you know, we're not going to be altering our policy with regard to Taiwan, and that we're also going to stand by our commitments made to Taiwan under the Taiwan Relations Act, which was signed into law at about the same time as the second communique. So I think now the situation has sort of been established that the U.S. policy is not going to change. Of course, between Beijing and Taipei, there's still some uncertainty with regard to what is the formulation by which they will continue to have interactions and, you know, continue to try to sort of move forward their relationship. I think... we're encouraging both sides to have communications directly with each other to avoid, you know, misunderstandings, misinterpretations, which can be very common in this kind of a relationship. There's, you know, a lot of interactions already between Taiwan and mainland China, economic, relationships and tourists back and forth. There's more than 100 flights back and forth every week. And so there's just a lot of things that come up in the relationship and need to be discussed. So we're encouraging them to continue to communicate and to continue to sort of, you know, move forward in their relationship. And we'll see how that goes between the two of them.
Jeremy, you had a question. You mentioned the diplomatic language, the, you know, finding the right terminology to talk about it. And that's an issue that came up with Secretary Tillerson's visit.
Yeah, that was, he came in for a lot of criticism for using typical Chinese government rhetoric like win-win. And, you know, and I personally read a lot of that criticism and thought, you know what, so what? That's such an easy win. Say the words they like. You know, that doesn't really... harm your position. But that put me in disagreement with a lot of writers and China watchers and various experts. What's your take on that?
Well, Secretary Tillerson said that win-win was Dale Carnegie's phrase, not the Chinese government's phrase. So I thought that was also a fair point. Yeah.
Yes.
No, I think, you know, sometimes people pay, you know, a lot of attention to these kind of small things that I think get too much sort of scrutiny. I think, you know, he was there on a first visit to meet his, you know, Chinese counterparts, the Chinese leader. He talked a lot about how, you know, we had managed well the last 40 years of this important relationship by relying on things like, you know, avoiding conflict, making sure we treat each other with respect, and having win-win outcomes. And he thought that that was a perfectly reasonable way to look at what has characterized our past relations and how it's helped us to manage relations. And I think that was, you know, a fair statement. And I think it was a little bit too much in the media focus after the trip, actually.
I would agree. One more question. I mean, since we started talking about your stint in the 2000s in China and how important human rights was, there are a lot of concerns now from the human rights community that rights issues will be backburnered by this administration, and that things like civil liberties and rights of minority nationalities and, of course, of religious freedoms and things like that, they won't be a priority in diplomacy with China, that there will be sort of explicit delinkage. Can you speak to this?
Sure. You know, I think, first of all, the Secretary has made very clear to all of us at the State Department that human rights are an integral part of sort of who we see ourselves as Americans, and it's not going to be delinked from our foreign policy. You know, we rolled out our human rights report this year. There was some criticism that he wasn't there. I mean, it was one of his first weeks in the department when we rolled that out. So I think we have to remember that it's still early on in the administration, and there's a lot of issues that we have to get to and tackle, and we will get there. We will tackle them, but they're not all going to be able to be tackled sort of top priority right out of the box. So, I mean, human rights is a big priority for the Secretary and for, I think, this administration. You know, the Secretary talked about human rights, religious freedom, raised specific human rights cases when he was in China. The President talked about human rights with Xi Jinping when he was at Mar-a-Lago. And I think, you know, it's clear to the Chinese that we're not going to be backing off this at all. I think for effective diplomacy on these issues, we have to work human rights issues into all our conversations with our Chinese counterparts. And we do that whether it's the Secretary of State or the President or even the Minister of Commerce or the Attorney General or, you know, other people who travel over there that work on scientific exchanges. A lot of our exchange with our Chinese counterparts is about improving governance, which also gets to protecting human rights. So I think there's many ways to get at this problem, but we won't be backing off human rights.
It's good to hear. One more question from the audience. I think it's a very interesting question. At this time in U.S.-China relations, in the bilateral relationship, what is the role of other countries in the Asia-Pacific region in maybe helping to smooth over the relationship between, I mean, in the past, we've seen countries like Singapore play a really important role. Maybe you could speak to that. I'm not sure what countries the asker had in mind, but maybe...
Well, I think, you know, managing and dealing with the rise of China is very important. It's maybe the most important issue for almost all of the countries in Asia. For all of the countries in Asia, China is, if not their number one trading partner, it's at least number two, and it's probably number one for most of them. I mean, these, you know, are very important relationships, and countries in Asia, they want to have those trading relationships. They want to be very tightly bound and interconnected economically with China, but they also want to have the United States there, present, and in evidence as sort of a guarantor of their security and a protector and a balancer. And I think that that's, you know, been, you know, continued to be very, very important to them. And we hear it, you know, a lot from countries in the region that they want to have their relationship with China, but they also want the U.S. there and they don't want to have to choose. I think for smoothing over the U.S. relationship with China, there's so many countries in Asia that are important. Our allies are very important, Japan, Korea, Australia, you know, of course, other friends in the region, New Zealand, Singapore, you mentioned.
I thought Australia was an enemy.
No, they're a great ally. You know, so there are a lot of connections there. Of course, the U.S. has been trying to participate actively in the ASEAN-related fora as a partner country, and will continue to do that. I mean, I think, you know, Singapore will continue to be very important as a partner to help us to interpret our relationship with China to other Asian partners. And I think Singapore, you know, has a good understanding of what they want to see U.S. engagement be in Southeast Asia. And they are very good at making sure that we are present and that we are active in the region. I think that'll continue to be important.
Excellent. Well, we want to be mindful of your time, so we want to thank you, first of all. I mean, I'm
getting
afraid
hungry.
That is, yeah. Well, welcome to come join us for dinner afterward, but that's all we have time for today. But Susan, thank you so much for taking the time to come in and chat with us. Do stick around and make a recommendation with us for this next segment. And let me quickly pay some bills here. Before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at subchina.com. You can follow SubChina on Twitter at SubChina News and on Facebook at facebook.com/SubChina News. If you like the Seneca Podcast, by all means, just go and leave us a positive review on the Apple App Store or on Google Play or wherever it is that you go to review apps. This really helps, and it means a lot to us. Now, on to recommendations. Jeremy, as is our tradition, you may be in.
Sure, very quickly, and maybe all of you in this room already know this, but there's a great WeChat daily account called Logi Siwei, Logical Thinking. It's exactly 1 minute every day in Chinese, and it starts off with a guanjianzhar, a keyword, and it's often related to a book or something that the guy who does it, Luo Zhenyu, has read, and he's a good entrepreneur. He makes various ways of monetizing it, and it's supposedly valued at ¥1 billion. But it's a really great way of staying in touch with not really big political issues, but kind of issues of society in mainland China, and getting a 1 minute superbly edited piece of Chinese. And it's very difficult to do exactly 1 minute. So it's a lot of work he puts into it. Anyway, Luo Zhisiwei.
Excellent one.
On WeChat.
I'm a big fan, yeah. Susan, what do you have for us?
Well, I have a book recommendation. I actually got this tip from my Canadian counterpart who does Asia, and I'm reading this book. It's going to take you a lot more than 1 minute. It's probably going to take several thousand minutes to get through this pretty thick book, but it's called The Immobile Empire by Alain Pierrefitte, who is a French author. But it's in translation in English, and it's available on used bookstores, and you can get it on Amazon. And it's about, when Lord Macartney went to China and had to go see Emperor Qianlong and refused to kowtow. And this goes into the archives on both sides and compares how the Chinese side and the British side looked at these incidents. And it's fascinating. And it's so, true for today's U.S.-China relationship in many, many aspects.
One of those true pivotal moments in history. I mean, absolutely. That famous letter that we've all read in every anthology on Chinese history.
Yes.
Fascinating stuff. So my recommendation is actually going to be one that David Moser made a few years ago on the show, but I'm going to have to reiterate it because I'm going to have to, double down on this one because it's just so good. It's Endymion Wilkinson's amazing tome. It's called Chinese History, A New Manual, and it is just a resource, not just a resource, not just a tool, but the articles themselves about every approach, every topic in Chinese history, whether you want to understand dates, if you want to understand geography, you want to understand the naming conventions, if you want to make sure that you're using pinyin correctly. It's all there. It's an amazing, amazing resource. I finally got myself a copy of it a couple of months ago, and it has just not left my bedside. I mean, every night I read a couple of the pieces from it. It's cannot recommend it more highly. Magisterial is the word that somehow every reviewer lands on when I was trying to avoid it, but it really is magisterial. And with that, I want to thank once again Acting Assistant Secretary of State Susan Thornton. Susan, so much, so wonderful for you to take the time to come
thanks.
And chat with us. We really hope you can have you back on the show again sometime. That'd be
love
great.
To.
All right. Jeremy?
Thank you, Kaiser.
As
thank
always,
you,
man. Yeah, thank you.
Thank
so
you.
We'll see you guys soon. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldhorn. Thanks also to Anla Chang and Soraya Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast. And, of course, follow us on Twitter at Seneca Podcast. Thanks for listening. Let's hear it one more time for Susan Thornton. Yeah. And take care.